Hey guys, it's Jill. Jen and I wanted to give you a heads up about the content on today's episode. It may be triggering for more sensitive audiences. Refer to the show notes for more specifics. And take care while you listen. On this episode of Common Mystics, we discover the never-before-told story of a woman whose mysterious life and shocking death continue to be shrouded by a veil of secrets. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are Common Mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today's story comes to you from Providence, Rhode Island.
That's right. Guys, you know what we do.
Jennifer, they know what we do.
We drive around the country looking for stories, taking hits, and then we do the research. But sometimes, Jennifer, sometimes when we do the research, we are compelled to tell a story that was brought to us by those same hits. Mm-hmm. And that's why we developed more voices from the road. So this is one of those stories.
That's true. And I'm also so excited because we are the first people ever to talk about this story since the newspapers covered it in the 1890s.
It is exciting.
I know. Oh my gosh.
And you know what? Just saying, I feel like there's still mystery here. For real.
There's
still a lot of mystery. Some things we can't verifiably say, like there's a lot of conjecture, but I have my own theories.
Well, I can't wait to hear them.
I know. I can't wait to share them. So why don't you remind everyone of our intention and where our story starts?
We came across these hits when we were traveling around New England. We were in Connecticut and we drove to Rhode Island to our hotel in Providence. And on the road, our intention that day was, as it always is, to find a verifiable story previously unknown to us that allows us to give voice to the voiceless. And so we asked the spirits to lead us to the voiceless.
That's right. Now, the hit that you were looking at when you found this story, what were they?
So we had been driving on the Danielson Pike. The Danielson Pike runs between Rhode Island and Connecticut.
And is it related to Ralph Macchio?
Danielson?
Mm-hmm.
Only if you say it like that.
Okay.
Danielson!
Okay.
Wax on, okay. Wax off. Yes, that was the pike we were on. For some reason, the pike in particular seemed significant, and I remember writing it in the notes, like, the pike is a thing.
Okay, I remember that. Now, what else did you reference?
Mm-hmm. So when we – do you remember when we stopped in Hopkins Mills?
Yeah.
Yeah, we discussed that stop at length in episode 96 of Common Mystics. But we were taking a lot of pictures there. And the craziest thing, all my pictures are labeled North Scituate in Hopkins Mills. We weren't in North Scituate. We were actually 7 miles west of North Scituate. But all my Apple labeled all my photos in Hopkins Mills North Scituate. So I was like, that's so confusing.
Oh, that's weird. Well, and I don't think it labeled mine that way. That's pretty weird. But your phone was acting legit off that day.
That's right. That was the day that, like, Spirit, like, took control of my phone for sure.
Interesting. So, we stopped at the cemetery when the phone was going bonkers.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't control my phone and it was like deleting stuff on me. But you were picking up on some very interesting things at that location.
That's right.
Tell me about it.
Woman's presence. It really did feel like it was a strong female vibe. Strong meaning not like a strong female lead, but like a very palpable feeling of a female with us. Mm-hmm. Also, apparently I said, I don't remember saying this, but you noted that there is a mystery and maybe we'll be able to shed some light on it.
Right. My exact quote in the notes that you said was, will we be able to solve it?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. You don't remember saying that?
No, not at all.
In that location, in that Hopkins Lot Cemetery, I was feeling, quote, heavy-hearted, as if I were shot in the chest. That's a quote from the notes.
Yes, I remember that.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I remember that specifically.
And then that was the moment where you suddenly wanted to text our friend.
Our friend Emily.
Our friend Emily. And you were like, I have to text her right now about something that happened 3 hours ago.
That's a true statement. That's a true right? statement. Sometimes I just get a bee in my bonnet. You know how I can be.
Right. And that woman's presence was with you that whole day as we went on to Portsmouth and Newport. And you were feeling what from this female energy?
Well, specifically when we were in Portsmouth, it felt like this female energy wanted to go home to Newport.
All right. So all of that would be relevant for this story, Jill.
Okay, I'm excited. So what did your research reveal to you?
Okay, I'll take you first to the incident.
What whoa, you just went incident.
Incident. Mm-hmm.
There was an incident?
There was an incident. Yep. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
It was late September of 1894, and all the news outlets out of Providence, Rhode Island, reported a grim discovery. On Friday, September 28th, 1894, a woman's body was discovered on the side of the road in a heavy growth of trees just off Hartford Pike, approximately a mile and a half from the village of North Scituate.
Stop it.
I'm serious. According to the Providence News, it was a, quote, half-witted man who
wow.
was just, I know, wandering around the countryside.
That's so rude. That is
I know.
So rude.
It was like
why did
a
you,
transient.
But why did they have to say half-witted? Why couldn't they just say some? There was a transient. Why did it have to be half-witted?
I don't know, but that's what the story said. Half-witted man was wandering around the countryside who made the discovery. He found the remains of a woman, the body of a woman. And so he alerted the people who lived there. And of course, they reached out to the local authorities.
Doesn't seem half-witted to me. Seems rather smart.
Okay. So the woman's remains were transported to the Scituate coroner's office, where the body was examined.
What were some of the things they found?
Excellent question.
Thank you.
Okay. The victim was estimated to be about 35 years old. And by her general appearance, she seemed to be, quote, in good standing. Now, what does that mean? That means she looked healthy. Like she didn't look like a street person. Like she appeared to be well cared for and healthy. And she was also fashionably dressed.
Ooh, girl.
Yeah. She had on new shoes and silk undergarments.
Yes.
And around her corset was a finely embroidered corset cover. She also wore jewelry, including a golden locket around her neck.
Well, that is interesting. So mm-hmm. she is going to a party. She is dressed in her finest. She's looking good. Okay. Mm-hmm.
The autopsy also revealed that she had been through quite a traumatic experience.
Okay, this is trigger palooza right now. Because when I read this outline, I was like, oh my God. So please note the trigger warning. This is rough to listen to.
So according to the papers, the autopsy found that the back of her head had been beaten so severely that it resembled, quote, jelly. And also parts of her body were terribly bruised, almost as if someone had taken a club and beaten her with it.
Oh, my God.
And then there was more. There were
more?
Yeah.
There's more.
Yes. And this is so troubling. There were circular wounds, like curved circular wounds on her face and on her cheeks. And it looked like they were from the hammer of a revolver, like someone had beat her in the face with a gun.
That poor, poor woman.
But the cause of death was not attributed to any of those injuries.
Oh my God.
I know. You see, what killed her was a .32 caliber bullet lodged in the left side of her chest, just above her heart.
Oh my God. So why go through all of that?
What do you mean?
If a bullet killed her, why are they beating the F out of her?
Exactly. Excellent question.
My God.
Well, there's more about the bullet. We'll come back to that. The angle of the bullet suggested that the killer had been on her left side and had shot her in the lower back with the gun pointed upward at an angle. And so the bullet traveled up and lodged above her heart. Oh, and the medical examiner also noted that there was a lack of gunpowder burns on the victim's clothing, suggesting that the murderer was holding the gun concealed in a coat pocket when he angled it up and shot her in the back.
The only blessing I heard out of any of that is the fact that she didn't know it was coming. True. And all that damage to her body and trauma happened after she was already passed on.
That is 100% accurate. All good news. Right. So like you just said, she had been shot first and killed. And then afterwards, the killer or killers clubbed her and mutilated her body and face and left her in the woods off Hartford Pike in North Scituate.
I can't imagine the type of person to do that amount of damage. Like, right. Oh my God.
It seems over the top.
Overkill. Like,
yes.
Like the two things that came to mind was either they were trying to damage her beyond recognition, or they were just so frenzied by the murder.
Passionate, infuriate. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. So the victim lay in the medical examiner's office for 3 days until she was able to be identified. And in the meantime, detectives did a solid, and they obtained a list of all the women who had been recently reported missing in the area.
I really like when police do good police work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This is like, this is the nuts and bolts of investigations. It makes me so happy. What did they find?
Well, they went through the list and they discovered that all of the women who had been recently reported missing were all found, except for one, a woman named Mrs. Emily Chambers of Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So now they had a name.
Now they had a name and a location of where she came from.
Great. That's right. The detectives went and located an acquaintance of Mrs. Emily Chambers. And her name was Annie Whalen, Mrs. Annie Whalen of Providence. And Mrs. Whalen accompanied investigators to the Scituate coroner's office to view the remains. Now, it was a scene.
When
she arrived at the coroner's office, there was a flood of newspaper reporters all trying to get statements and ask her questions. And there were also, quote, village gossips all gathered around waiting and asking her questions. But she had been well prepared by the detectives. And the detectives are like, don't talk to anyone. Don't say anything. Just look and make a mental note and then tell us later what your conclusions are.
That poor Mrs. Whalen, can you even imagine?
No, that must have been terrible.
Tragic.
So after she viewed the remains of her friend, she then went to the medical examiner's office to view the victim's personal belongings. And based on that, Mrs. Whalen was able to make a positive identification of her friend, Mrs. Emily Chambers, by not only her facial features and her hair, but also her clothing and personal belongings, including a ring, a gold locket, and a pair of blue stockings that had been mended in violet yarn. And they were the very same stockings that had been mended by Emily herself a few days before at Mrs. Whalen's house.
That is so heartbreaking.
So,
and it sounds like something Grandma would do. I can picture Grandma sewing right. socks with the yarn.
With the wrong color?
Yes.
It's close enough.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
So who was Emily? What do we know about her?
Mrs. Emily Chambers was born Emily Drummond in Ireland around the year 1854. She was about 41 years old at the time of her murder, not 35, the way the coroner had estimated.
So she looked good. She had a hot girl summer. Yes, she did.
What were your secrets, Emily?
Tell us everything.
Seriously, I wonder what the anti-aging regimen was back in the 1890s. Anyway, we know that at some point, Emily Drummond immigrated to the United States and settled in Newport, Rhode Island. And she made a life for herself there. And one of the jobs that she had was as a, quote, domestic.
What does that mean?
Which was a maid, basically, a domestic worker.
Okay.
And she was a domestic worker in the city of Newport for about 20 years. Now, the newspapers reported that Emily had been married twice. I could find no information about her first husband, but I did find information on her second husband. His name was William Chambers, and they married in 1886. And William had served in the Navy and worked as a machinist at a naval station in Newport. Sadly, Emily and William were only married for about 4 years, as William died in the Newport Hospital in 1890.
Oh, that's super sad.
It is. Now, following William's death, Emily relocated to Providence, Rhode Island, presumably because she had family there. She had two brothers, David and Frank, who were both living in Providence. And so when Emily moved there, she took a job as a table girl at a local hotel, the Hotel Hallett.
What is a table girl?
From what I could make out, a table girl was a waitress or server.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense.
And then, after a stint at the Hotel Hallett as a table girl, she got a job as a live-in domestic worker at the home of Mr. William Gilbane.
Would you rather work with the public or work in a specific household?
I want to say in a specific household, as long as it was like a good household with people who were kind to me there.
Okay.
But I don't really like people. I'm more of an introvert.
That's true. I would feel uncomfortable living in someone's house, though.
I mean, you'd be family after a while, don't you think?
Hopefully. I mean, best case scenario, but still.
So you'd rather work with the public at a hotel?
I mean, if those were my two options, I would rather have my own apartment and work with the public, yeah.
Wow. I would 100% rather be a live-in domestic for a family. Anyway, Emily was last seen by friends and acquaintances on Wednesday, September 26th, 1894, 2 days before her body was discovered. But here's the thing, Jill.
Tell me.
When the evidence surrounding Emily's murder emerged, her friends could not explain her recent actions. And it appears...
What actions?
Well, it appears that she had plans that she was keeping from them.
Okay. That's awfully suspicious. Mm-hmm. Don't hold back. Tell me everything. What do we know? What's Em doing?
Okay. On Wednesday, September 26th, the last day she was seen alive...
Okay.
Emily resigned from her position at the Gilbane house.
Oh, interesting.
She quit her job.
And the place that she's living.
Exactly.
So that's two in one. Okay.
Uh-huh. So basically, she decides she's not living there anymore.
And not working there anymore.
Right. That same afternoon, after she quits her position at the Gilbane house, She goes to the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in Providence, and she makes a payment of $1.50 on her life insurance policy.
That's interesting.
Isn't it? And then at the time of her visit at the life insurance company, the insurance agent noted that Emily only had about a dollar left on her after she made the payment.
Interesting. This is all interesting.
Then the next day, September 27th, mm-hmm. Thursday, a woman who was later identified as Emily rented a horse and covered carriage at the Franklin Brothers stables around 2:30 p.m.
So basically she rented a car.
Yes. It was a covered carriage, remember. So it wasn't an open buggy. It had a top and it had windows with curtains.
Okay.
Okay, that's important. And workers at the stables referred to this woman who made the rental agreement as a mysterious woman because she never left her name.
Also, I would think that if you're getting a covered carriage, that mm-hmm. would be more expensive too. So I'm wondering, like, what does this cost? The woman had a dollar on her.
Well, here's the thing. The workers at the stables noted that the woman who rented the carriage had a lot of cash on her. Not only did she pay for the carriage in advance, but she also had a large roll of bills in her possession.
Emily, where'd you get your money? Uh-uh.
Right, because the day before she only had a dollar left at the insurance place.
Yes, and now she's splurging on like a closed carriage. Right. And where are you going? Like, what are you doing, Emily?
And she's got a wad of cash.
Okay.
So friends indicated that Emily had actually been expecting her pension money, which she had been receiving since the death of her husband, William, 4 years earlier. So it was assumed that she received her pension payment that very day or perhaps the day before she rented the carriage.
Okay.
Okay. Dude, timing is everything.
This is well planned is what I'm feeling, but go on.
Okay. So not only was the rental curious.
Because she didn't leave her name.
Right. And she had like this big wad of cash.
Mm-hmm.
But also there were curious circumstances surrounding the delivery of the carriage.
What do you mean?
Well, the woman left detailed instructions and it was to be dropped off at 187 Pine Street in Providence at 4 p.m. that afternoon. But when a stable worker went to deliver the carriage to the address, 187 Pine Street, he found that that address did not exist.
Okay. Did she not know her own address?
Good question. Instead, he went to 197 Pine Street and saw the woman waiting there. And I guess it was an error with the street number.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to put too much on that only because we don't know whose error it was. We don't know if it was the woman's or someone
right.
writing it down.
So exactly.
So I'm going to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Nothing suspicious. Keep going.
But then the woman also told him, don't hitch the horse yet. Don't assemble the carriage and the horse together because, quote, my mother isn't quite ready yet.
I'm so confused.
And as far as we can tell, Emily's mother didn't live in Providence. So that really curious.
Okay. So this is what I know so far based on your outline. Mm-hmm. This is what I know. I know that Emily had mm-hmm. a bunch of money and rented a fancy, fancy carriage with like covered with curtains, everything. And she's going somewhere with that carriage. And
right.
we know that she was found murdered on a pike outside of the city, okay?
Right.
We know
yes.
that. So could it have been that someone, like, carriage-jacked her and, like, rode up, like, next to the carriage, was like, pull over, pull over, and then, like, took the carriage and, like, beat her up and shot Ooh. Her and then, like, stole the carriage and the horse and they can put, like, an all-out bulletin for the carriage and the horse and find out who took the carriage and the horse and who killed Emily? Is that where we're going?
Well, not exactly. We don't know what happened after the carriage was dropped off, but we do know that the carriage was returned the next
Shut up.
That evening, around 11 o'clock. Here's what happened.
Did mom return it?
It was not mom. It was a strange teenage boy, an unnamed boy, who simply dropped it off at the stables around 11 p.m. that night and walked away without saying a word to anyone.
I mean, that's, I don't know. Is it like returning a library book? I don't know. I guess.
Maybe.
Right? I guess
they
I don't
put
really.
The keys in the Dropbox?
Yes. Yeah. Maybe it's not that suspicious, but who's the boy? Because Emily's dead.
We don't know who the boy was. He is unnamed in the papers. But that wasn't the only strange thing, Jill.
Okay.
Because the following morning, that Friday, in the light of day, when they were cleaning out the carriage, stable workers found a woman's black shawl in the carriage seat and bloodstains on the cushions.
No.
Yes.
So to recap, Emily
gets
all dressed up in her finest, pays her life insurance policy, cashes out her husband's pension, quits her job, leaves her home, rents a fancy carriage under very mysterious circumstances, to say the least. And then she winds up dead. The carriage is returned with bloodstains and her shawl.
By a boy who's unnamed.
By a boy. Okay.
That's right.
Okay. Obviously, someone else is involved in this. What do we know? Who is she with? I need answers right this second. Tell me everything.
No one could say where Emily was planning to go that day, but there are plenty of witnesses who saw Emily that Thursday afternoon driving on Hartford Pike in that rented carriage, and she was not alone.
I knew it.
They said that there was a man with her.
It's always a man. How can they be so sure that this was Emily and a dude, and not just any different couple on the pike? Like, I'm assuming this is a well-traveled pike. Like, there's other carriages on the pike?
Yes, yes. Well, here's an interesting thing that happened that day. When the stable hands were prepping the carriage for the rental, they noticed that the horse's shoe was messed up. It was like missing a nail or something. And so at the last minute, they had to switch out the nice horse for a horse named Nettie. And Nettie was this small black horse that had a cropped mane and a banged up tail. And that was the only horse they had available. So poor Nettie was a downgrade, and she would have stood out on this carriage. And there are multiple witnesses who told authorities that the carriage had this small black horse.
Okay, I just have to say Nettie sounds adorable. I don't even care. I would be like, Nettie, oh my God, you're so cute.
Don't you hate when you do that? Don't you hate when you rent a car and then you go there and they're like, yeah, that car's not here. And you're like, but that is the car that I put money down on. And they're like, yeah, no, we have to give you something else.
Literally, that happened the last time I rented a car, and that's why they dropped off the car at the house, because I was like, you need to get me the car that I asked for,
right?
And then they brought it here. Anyway, yeah. No.
That sucks when it happens.
But it's Nettie, though, and Nettie sounds really cute.
Nettie does sound cute. But there were more witnesses, too. It wasn't just witnesses who placed Emily on the pike with a man in this carriage driven by this little black horse named Nettie. There was an electric car conductor in Providence, and he said that he was accosted by a man who was driving in a carriage with a small black horse on Thursday evening. And he said there was a woman in a carriage with him. And he said that the man was looking for the road to Scituate, and he was asking the conductor for directions.
Okay.
And the conductor remembered the interaction, and he was able to provide a description of the man.
Yeah, because it was the only man ever that stopped and asked for directions. That's why, because that is literally why, because no man ever will stop and ask.
That is very, very true. That
right?
would be notable.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, he said, was, quote, below medium size. So he was a little guy.
He's short. A little guy.
He had a, quote, sandy complexion and a, quote, light-colored mustache, and he was wearing a black slouch hat. And the newspapers printed this description along with other details, saying that the man also had blue eyes and that he appeared younger than Emily.
Then I bet he's the guy that returned the carriage, just saying, because they had described the kid as a kid.
Well, maybe.
Okay. So were there other witnesses, like when they got to Skidgewit?
Well, it was nighttime and there were no witnesses in Skidgewit, but there's super interesting information that was shared by a married couple who lived on a farm just off Hartford Pike.
What?
This couple had a farm. They were Mr. and Mrs. Charles Hopkins, and they lived at the intersection at Hartford Pike and Elmdale Road. And can I just tell you an interesting side note about that intersection?
Tell me.
There is, or was, in the 1890s, a little village there called Old Bank Village, right at that intersection. And it was called Old Bank Village because in the 1700s, there was a guy who lived there. His name was Gideon Harris. And Gideon Harris built this big house at that intersection. And he was well-to-do, and he was a pillar of society. And he was like the town clerk or something. And he was a prominent man. But, Jill, he was also really generous to the poor. And so people who were destitute or who needed a loan or who needed help would go to this house and ask Gideon Harris for help. And he would always help them out and give them money. And so they called his house the Old Bank.
Aww.
And so that area at that intersection was called Old Bank Village because Gideon Harris's house was there and he always helped out the poor.
That's really sweet.
Don't you love that?
That gives me goosebumps.
I know.
Thank you, Gideon.
So anyway, back to Mr. and Mrs. Charles Hopkins, who lived just south of Old Bank Village, right off the intersection of Elmdale Road and Hartford Pike. Now, the farmhouse sat close enough to the road so that they could hear all the traffic noise on the pike.
Mm.
Not ideal. That's not good planning.
No, it's not.
So between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m., on Thursday, September 27th, Mr. and Mrs. Hopkins heard two gunshots go off in very quick succession. And then they heard a carriage speeding furiously northward towards Hartford Pike. And Mrs. Hartford heard the carriage cross a bridge and turn onto the soft sand to head west on the pike. See, she could tell by the sound of the wheels which
right.
direction it had turned. Then about 15 minutes later, Mr. and Mrs. Hopkins heard the carriage again, this time heading onto the road towards the village of North Skidgewit. And then the next day, in the light of the morning, there were tracks discovered near the Hopkins property that were indicative of a light city carriage. See, not the heavy farm vehicle tracks that you would normally see on a farm. And also nearby, Jill, was located a piece of wood with three corners that had no blood on it, but did have one long strand of hair that was stuck in one of its splinters. And that hair matched Emily's.
Oh.
And Emily's body was found in Skidgewit in a heavily wooded area just off the pike. So everything the Hopkins heard was very consistent with Emily's story and where they found her.
What makes me think of is that Emily was alive when they first heard the carriage.
Yes.
Then the gunshots.
Then the gunshots.
Yeah, that's rough. That's really rough.
So based on this evidence, investigators put together that Emily was shot in the area near Hopkins Farm while sitting in the carriage next to the shooter and then driven to Skidgewit where her body was dumped on the side of the road.
Okay, but when and why did all that mutilation take place? We know that the couple was together for at least 6 hours, like 4 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
So why, like, I mean, I don't know how long it would take them to get to Hopkins Farm.
About an hour and a half.
That's a long time.
Right. So there's a big chunk of time where we have no idea where they drove or what they were doing.
Right.
What even the plan was. We have no clue. All we know is that between 10 and 11, that's where they were located.
Right. And then who was the dude?
Oh.
Who was the man with Emily?
Good question. Well, investigators made an arrest on October 3rd, 1894.
Who?
Lawrence C. Keegan was arrested at the house of his landlady, Mrs. Bacon, in Providence, Rhode Island.
Everybody likes bacon.
Mm.
Would you live at Mrs. Bacon's house?
Absolutely. I bet it smelled delicious.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So what do we know about Larry?
Lawrence Keegan. We know that he was born in Ireland around 1842, and he was a silver plater by trade.
What does that mean?
He plated jewelry and silver.
Oh, okay.
That was his job.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And he was married in Providence in 1864. He and his wife lived in New Haven until 1873, when his wife died of the dropsy after an extended illness.
What's the dropsies?
The dropsy refers to swelling or edema that these days we know is associated with like heart failure, kidney disease, aww, or liver disease. Yeah.
It's such a cute name for a horrible disease.
I guess. Now, since 1873, Lawrence had lived in Providence as a widower. He also had a history of trouble with the law.
Yikes.
Yeah. See, he had been arrested a number of times due to drunkenness.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not throwing stones.
Nor should you. He had been living as a boarder at Mrs. Bacon's house for about 8 years, and he appears to have been unemployed at the time of Emily's murder, or at least not steadily working.
Mm.
And one of the other boarders who lived at Mrs. Bacon's said that when he was drunk, Lawrence Keegan was, quote, one of the ugliest men he had ever knew.
Okay, so I'm really confused why they arrested this old loser drunk. No offense, well, Larry. I'm just saying, does not fit the description of the man that we that stopped and asked for directions with Emily, and does not fit the teenage boy description of who returned the carriage. So why was old ass drunken Larry picked up on this murder?
Well, he did fit some of the description components. For instance, he was a small build. He was only 5'4".
Oh, that's way little. He's a little angry drunk, is what you're saying.
I guess. He had brownish gray hair, and he did have a mustache. But like you said, he was older, not younger than Emily, as the papers reported, and his eyes weren't blue. Actually, one source said they were, quote, indescribable in color. I don't get that.
What? I mean, if we found a way to name Liz Taylor's eyes, we couldn't find out what Larry's eyes color were.
I was thinking maybe he had glaucoma or something. You know how glaucoma makes them look kind of cloudy?
Yes. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the guy. First of all, Emily, she got dressed up. She was looking fly. You don't have to look fly for this old dude that might have glaucoma. Like, what are we saying?
Well, to be sure, there do seem to be discrepancies in the witnesses' descriptions of the culprit. That is true. More on that later. But those who saw him agreed that Lawrence had a scraggy sort of appearance, like his facial hair was scraggy and he was wearing slouchy clothes and he was decrepit and arthritic and not well cared for. And he seems to have been primarily known as the town drunk. So he wasn't like an upstanding citizen. He was a guy who was like a street person who had like trouble with the law and probably made bad decisions because of his drinking.
Okay, but again, Emily, our Emily, is a woman of good standing, and I quote from the paper, had a bunch of money, rented a nice carriage, was like, why? This doesn't make sense.
They were looking at Lawrence, and when they interviewed him, there were problems with Lawrence's
interview?
Alibi. Mm-hmm. His interview, yeah.
Okay, well, he's a drunk, so, I mean, ask me what I ate last night. Can't tell you what happened during the interview process. Poor little drunken Larry got himself into trouble. What happened?
So when interviewed, Lawrence told conflicting stories about his interactions with Emily. In the first interview, he said that he used to know Emily, but long ago, before she got married, and he hadn't seen her since April of that year. But later, he said that he had been in her company since April, but he hadn't seen her since September. But witnesses were like, no, 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 we saw them together in September.
So witnesses, actual witnesses, saw the two of these two people together?
Witnesses, yes, testified that they had seen Lawrence and Emily together in September. Yes.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. But when poor Lawrence was asked where he was on September 27th, the day of the murder, he told very conflicting accounts. First, he said that he went to the saloons on Pine and Clifford Streets, and then to the Grimes Saloon, and then to the saloons on the corner of Pine and Richmond.
Yeah, he did.
And then
it all checks out to me.
And then in the next interview, he said, well, he wasn't sure about his whereabouts that afternoon, but he definitely went to Sullivan and Farrell's Saloon and then to Grimes. And then in the third interview, he said, well, he went to saloons on Pine and Dyer and Clifford Streets, and then to Way Bossett Street, and then to Grimes. So his story kept changing.
You know what, though? It all checks out to me. Like, that all makes sense to me. I understand exactly what happened. He got drunk. He did his private little pub crawl. He went to all those places. I bet you he did. I don't know which order, but he's been to them all in that night.
For sure. Like, that is 100% consistent with someone who was drinking all day.
Exactly.
Like, who the fuck knows where I was?
Exactly.
Right. Nonetheless, his changing story was considered evidence of his guilt.
Gosh.
Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to unveil the first book in our series entitled Common Mystics Present Ghost on the Road Volume 1, Murders and Mysterious Deaths.
It's everything you love about common mystics and more.
It's a retelling of 10 of our favorite stories from our pod with exciting extras.
Extras like souvenirs, what we took away from the experience, and what to know if you go, if you decide to travel in our footsteps.
Pre-order the Kindle edition now. All other formats of the book will be available for purchase at Amazon.com on July 1st, 2023.
Thanks, guys. Now back to the show.
But there was more evidence, Jill, and this one is a little harder to laugh off.
Okay.
Lawrence had access to a gun.
Okay. What does that mean?
Okay, let me explain. A week before the murder, Lawrence had borrowed a .32 caliber revolver from a man named Arthur Taylor of Woodbine. And when he went to Taylor's to borrow the weapon, Taylor asked him, what are you going to do, kill somebody? And Lawrence replied that no, he was going to take a trip into the country and he wanted to protect himself from tramps on the road. And when Lawrence returned the revolver on Saturday, 2 days after the murder, it had been, quote, cleaned to a polish, and 5 cartridges were missing out of the box that Taylor lent him. Yeah.
Larry.
I know.
Well, first of all, I would not give the town drunk my gun and then be like, ha ha, wait, are you going to kill someone with it? Ha ha. It's like, if that's your question, you don't give them the gun. Lastly, the clean to a polish, I would assume like you, if you're borrowing something, you would make it look nice when you give it back. You know what I mean?
Maybe.
I don't know. Okay. Well, I don't know. So I guess this is where I'm headed with this. This is what we're assuming. We have the town drunk that people seen Emily with in the past, whatever. She gets all dressed up in her finest, rents a nice carriage for him because
with
he
a crappy
broke,
little horse.
Yeah, because he's broke and drunk, and she's gonna take all her money from her husband's pension and, like, I don't know, have like a vacation with the town drunk. What are we saying? Is that what the assumption is? Because Emily, you can do so much better. What?
All right. Remember Mrs. Whalen, Mrs. Annie Whalen, the friend of Emily's who actually identified her?
Mm-hmm.
She believed that Lawrence Keegan was Emily's lover.
Oh.
Now.
Oh, Mrs. Whalen.
Emily never said this to Mrs. Whalen outright, But apparently, Emily would talk about a love interest, but she would use pseudonyms. So she would not use the real name of her lover. And Mrs. Whalen knew this because she would like change the name. So Emily was like, oh, I'm going to go see Martin. I mean, Lawrence. And then correct herself. I mean, Martin.
Okay. First of all, I cannot believe it. I do understand if you're dating like a big loser, you would want to keep it secret. Like, I totally get it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that you would get that dressed up. Like, I understand, like, if, like, I've dated losers, you know what I mean? I didn't get all fancied up to take them out like on a vacation, you know what I mean? So that mm-hmm. seems suspicious to me. But why do you think she's being so secretive about, like, ooh, Martin? I mean, oh, Lawrence, no, Martin. Ooh.
I mean, that's the question. That's the question. I don't put these two together personally.
There's no way.
Yeah. But there's more.
There's more?
Yes. Apparently, Emily told people, apparently she told her parents that she was going to marry the man whom she was nursing to health.
Oh.
And everybody knew that Keegan was afflicted with rheumatism. And so the thinking was that she's nursing Keegan back to health and then planning to marry him.
This is so ridiculous. So Emily, this beautiful woman who looks years younger than she is, mm-hmm. gets all dressed up mm-hmm. to date the town drunk who has rheumatism, like may have glaucoma. What are we saying? This doesn't make sense.
I don't get it either.
Again, if you're dating a loser, you don't need to get all dressed up in your finest. Like, she was going out. She wanted to look beautiful. You don't need to look beautiful for the town drunk who has glaucoma and rheumatism. Oh.
Even if you're going to get married?
Well, she's definitely not marrying Larry, Jennifer. Definitely.
Well, it's interesting that he's described as slouchy and like unkempt, like even when he's spotted in the carriage, because if he was going to get married, wouldn't he get dressed up in his finest?
That's such a good point.
But anyway, based on the circumstantial evidence, including his purported relationship with Emily, his access to a revolver, his ever-changing story, and his history of run-ins with the law, Lawrence Keegan was turned over to the sheriff for prosecution, and was facing a murder trial.
Oh, my Lord, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. Guess what he pled?
James, I hope he pled not guilty because this is ridiculous.
He did plead not guilty, and he strenuously denied any involvement with the crime.
I agree with that statement.
The trial lasted a week, and in the months leading up to it, it caused a sensation in Providence, as well as all the little neighboring towns, including Foster and Scituate. There was rampant gossip about this murder. Everybody had an opinion about what had happened to Emily and who was responsible.
See, to me, I feel like if everyone had an opinion about it, it's because, like, this shit ain't right. You know what I'm saying? Like,
mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
This doesn't make sense. That's why there are so many differing opinions. Okay?
Right. And there were people in Scituate, a very vocal group, who believed that a different man was guilty. And many people were pointing fingers to a younger man named Oatley, who lived in Johnston. Let me tell you about Oatley.
Tell me about – I think Oatley is a cute name for a dog.
Oatley is a great name. Okay. So this guy, Oatley, he's a young man. He's in a buggy with his dad, and they are on, like, the Hartford Pike. And mm-hmm. he sees the doctor, i.e. the medical examiner, driving towards him and his dad in the buggy. And he actually says in a panic, oh man, here's a medical examiner going to check out the murdered woman. That's what he says to his dad. And then he jumps out of the buggy and hides in the trees until the doctor passes by.
Wow. See, yes. That is a dim-witted man for so many different reasons and guilty AF.
That happened. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people in Scituate were like, Oatley totally did it. They have the wrong guy. But a huge, huge number of witnesses were called to participate in this trial. And remember, this is a circumstantial case.
At best.
There is no concrete evidence tying Lawrence Keegan to Emily at all. It is all hinging on the testimony of witnesses.
And I would want to say, if somebody put those two together, like you said, it's probably him being like, hey, can I get a quota so I can get a, you know what I mean? It was not like.
Right, but probably not with a Brooklyn accent.
More with an Irish accent.
I can try maybe Irish.
Okay.
All right. All right. We'll practice that later. So apparently 25 witnesses were called for the defense and several more were called for the prosecution. The Providence News reported that, quote, if this sort of thing continues, the whole population from Olneyville Square to the Old Bank Village in Scituate is likely to figure on the witness stand.
I love it.
So they're like, is everybody going to be a witness? Like the entire population?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's all based on he saw, she saw, I didn't see, could have seen, might have seen.
Exactly. That's all.
And you know, literally eyewitness accounts, although we put so much like emphasis on it, is the most unreliable piece of evidence even today.
True. So, yep. True.
I ain't lying.
And you have to remember, this is a situation that probably some people wanted to be a part of it just because of the excitement. Like
yes.
Nothing like this ever happens in North Scituate. You know what I'm saying? Little town.
Yes. And you know those kind of people that make everything about them.
Yes.
Be like, my brother's sister's cousin friend knew a guy that met the girl who's dated Emily before. And you're like, okay.
Exactly. It's your 5 minutes of fame. It's your chance to like be in the papers and sit on the stand and talk to important investigators about what you know. So, yeah, you're going to have some of that, too.
Oh, my God.
So, obviously, the prosecution has this circumstantial case lacking any material evidence whatsoever tying Lawrence Keegan to Emily Chambers' murder. And both sides relied heavily on all of those eyewitness testimonies.
But, Jennifer, those eyewitness testimonies are contradictory.
They were. They were very contradictory, and many seemed unreliable under cross-examination.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So there were witnesses for the prosecution who placed Lawrence Keegan on Hartford Pike in the carriage with Emily. So people driving by were like, oh, yeah, I saw him on the pike with Emily.
But it was a covered carriage, Jennifer. It was exactly. A covered carriage.
Yes, it was a covered carriage, and the windows had curtains. So could they really be 100% that this man that they never met was under a carriage with, you know what I'm saying?
Like exactly.
Like, how reliable is that?
The evidence that people saw Nettie, I can understand because she was a smaller horse, kind of jacked up with her hair. Cute, but a little jacked up. That I get because that's totally visible. And you'd be like, oh, that's an unfortunate horse.
Right.
But you can't see inside that carriage. You don't know what's going on in there.
Right, exactly. And so when witnesses were asked, well, what did he look like? Some were like, he was young, he was old, he had a mustache, he had a beard, he had sandy hair, he had red hair. Like, it was all over the place.
It's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Also, just as there were witnesses who placed Lawrence and Emily on the pike together, they also called witnesses to the stand for the defense who could place Lawrence in Providence, in town, at the very time that other witnesses were placing him on the pike with Emily.
Wow. Can we just stop this now, like deem this a mistrial, save the taxpayers money because this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And then there was his landlady, Mrs. Bacon.
Mrs. Bacon.
And Mrs. Bacon was like, look, this man not only, yes, he's an ornery drunk, but there's no way he is capable of this. And he never missed a meal. Like this man never missed a meal. And there was nothing. And she kept a diary. And there was nothing unusual about Lawrence on that day. On Thursday, September 27th, he was there for his meals. He read the paper. He went to bed, right? After he had gone out into the saloons, that is.
You know what? That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So the circumstantial evidence of the prosecution was based not only on witness testimony that Keegan was in the carriage with Emily headed to Scituate, but also that he had access to the borrowed gun and Emily's wad of cash was missing, presumably taken by the killer. And that amount, Jill, amounted to $50, which would be a little more than $1,800 today.
So the prosecution's case and what they argued was that Larry murdered Emily in this horrific way just to get $1,800.
Right. Which is a lot of money to be carrying around with you, but murder worthy? I don't know.
And that angry murder worthy?
Yeah.
It's very short term. And you know what else makes me really, if that was the case, the planning that Emily did before seems contradictory to that kind of snap judgment to kill someone for that $1,800. She would be worth more alive because she's getting more money.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I don't know. I don't believe it.
I know. But the media at the time considered the circumstantial argument rock solid.
Oh, my God.
They did. And on February 2nd, 1895, the Providence News reported, quote, "The net of circumstances which the prosecution has woven was complete in every mesh." So they were like, yeah, this is a rock solid circumstantial case for sure.
At the very beginning of the story, I did not like this reporter, and I stand by that initial assessment. He's a prick. I do not like him.
Still, different newspaper outlets supported different sides of the argument, and it was unclear which way the jury would go.
They have to acquit this man. This is stupid. Stupid.
The closing argument of the defense was published in the Providence News on February 4th, 1895. And in it, the defense reminded the jurors that after all those witness testimonies, there are only two facts that could be established without a doubt. And one was that Emily Chambers left Mrs. Whalen's house on September 27th at 1:40 p.m. And two, she was murdered later that day. Every other aspect of the case was debatable.
Wow.
In addition, the identity of the woman who rented the carriage and the woman who was there at the drop-off could not be confirmed. Remember all the strangeness surrounding the rental and the drop-off, Jill? The wrong address, the woman saying that her mother wasn't ready. Like, was that even Emily? Also,
we don't know.
The stable worker who dropped off the carriage and saw the woman was shown a drawing of Emily, and they're like, is that her? And he said, well, the woman I saw had a thinner face.
That's rude.
So we don't even know. We don't even know if that was Emily.
That's rude. What about the gun?
Well, the defense reminded the jury, just because Lawrence had possession of a borrowed revolver did not mean that he murdered Emily. He told the owner of the gun that he wanted to protect himself from the people on the country roads. And remember the tramp who found Emily's body?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that checks out. Apparently, there were, like, just people wandering through the countryside that could be dangerous.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Right?
That's a really good point.
So, yeah, that checks out.
I've actually met aggressive tramps before.
You have?
Wouldn't want to kill them. Oh, yeah. Wouldn't want to kill him, but there are aggressive tramps out there.
Mm-hmm. And so what that he polished the revolver to a shine before he gave it back? It happened to be a new gun.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a brand new gun. And so he wanted to clean it off before he gave it back. And he didn't even try to conceal the fact that some of the cartridges were used. Like, he didn't hide them. He didn't replace them. Like, he just gave it back. He's like, yeah, I used some of your shit.
The evidence that was presented is a joke. I feel like, again, this is a sham.
But Jill, most importantly, and I want to say this nice and loud, the prosecution was not able to establish that Lawrence had any kind of relationship with Emily at all. Nobody who knew Lawrence was like, yeah, they're going out. Nobody.
Boom.
Nobody. Nor did they even put forth a motive for this murder other than suggesting it was committed for the cash that she was carrying?
Yeah. So he was acquitted.
Well, let me tell you what really happened. On February 5th, 1895, after 3 hours of deliberation, the verdict was read aloud. Jill, the courtroom was packed to the doors. And outside the doors, people lined the hallways waiting to hear the fate of Lawrence C. Keegan.
Oh, God.
The jury found Lawrence Keegan guilty, guilty of the murder of Emily Chambers, and he was sentenced to life in prison.
I am stunned. I am very disappointed in the jury. I do not understand how they came to that conclusion. Like, literally.
Especially because their job is to ask, is he guilty beyond the shadow of a doubt? And I don't understand how any of them could find, had no doubt about the witness testimony and this circumstantial case. It doesn't make sense to me either.
It makes absolutely no sense. And I'm angry with these jurors. I want to find them and question them and be like, what are you thinking?
I did find some information in the papers that helped clear up maybe why he was found guilty.
Explain yourself.
Well, Lawrence did not handle himself well during the trial.
He's a serious alcoholic with rheumatoid arthritis. How is he supposed to handle himself?
Well, he seemed to be enjoying the spotlight. He was smiling and chatting with the reporters. Oh. He was cheerful and appeared to be, quote, in the best of humor. And while other people in the courtroom were thoughtful and silent and like taking things seriously, he was telling jokes to his attorneys and cackling out loud.
Larry, like, that's a bad look, dude.
Bad look. Bad look.
Bad.
Also, he was heckling the jurors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was legit making fun of them. One guy he pointed out and said he had more spinach than he did. Spinach is a slang term for either facial hair or money. So I don't know if the joke was about the guy's facial hair or if he looked like well-to-do, but he was making fun of his, quote, spinach.
Wow.
Also, he said another one looked so dumb that he didn't know enough to come in from the rain. And then another juryman looked so elderly that Lawrence said he looked like he would drop dead before the end of the trial.
He was saying this to them?
Yes. While they were on the stand, he's like making fun of the jurors.
Oh, Larry, that's not smart.
There's another thing too. While his attorneys were selecting the jurors, Lawrence was really adamant that he wanted the people chosen for his jury to have knowledge of the case because he didn't want anybody judging him who didn't have the sense enough to read the papers. So he was choosing people who already had some background knowledge and probably had their own opinions about him. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So the attorneys were like getting rid of people who like didn't know anything about the case and bringing in people with preconceived notions. And as it turns out, that looked like it bit him in the butt.
Really bad.
Yeah. And not only that, Lawrence was pretty certain he was going to be acquitted. And the newspapers were printing this like, yeah, this dude's not even taking this trial seriously. He assumes he's going to be acquitted.
I mean, seriously, I legit thinks he should have been acquitted, but you don't heckle your jury. Like,
no.
That's really bad. Although that's bad, and like, Larry obviously is not the best person, like, he's an angry drunk, that doesn't mean that he's guilty of this crime.
Right. It actually would be consistent with someone who is innocent because he's like, this is such a joke. I didn't do it. Get anybody out here. Let's just get this over with. But so, it didn't ingratiate himself to the people who were making the decision about him.
So Larry,
yes,
he gets convicted of Emily's murder.
He does.
What happens next?
He appeals and he's denied a new trial.
Oh, Larry.
On January 24th, 1896, he was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of Emily Chambers. And the census records in the year 1900 place him in Rhode Island State Prison. And then 10 years later, in 1910, the census records show him living in Providence, Rhode Island, in a bookbinding factory with other prisoners and employees. You know how they did that, right? They took prisoners and like put them in a factory and it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he could not be located in subsequent census documents, so we can only assume that he died sometime between 1910 and 1920 as a prisoner, and he would have been in his 70s at this time.
Well, that's a very long life for someone who was running around drunk AF all over Providence.
True, true. So, Jill, who do you think our voiceless is?
Well, I'm really confused by this.
Because?
Because, like, Larry obviously needs a voice because he definitely did not do this crime. The only thing he's guilty of is being a foolish drunk.
Right. He was probably a menace in town. He was a buffoon at the trial.
You ain't lying.
He did himself no favors.
None at all.
And I don't think his neighbors liked him. He was a ne'er-do-well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
I know exactly. Mrs. Bacon liked him, though.
Mrs. Bacon did like. I think she was sweet on him.
Oh, I can see that. That's
in her diary, she would write things like L. She referred to him as L in her diary. L is okay today, meaning he wasn't drunk. So she was like worried about him. And they also asked her if she noted in her diary, like when he paid her for like rent. And she's like, oh, I don't keep track of that.
Wow.
I know. So she was basically just giving him a place to live for like free.
And feeding him.
And feeding him. Yes. Jill, do you think that Lawrence and Emily had a romantic relationship?
Absolutely not. If they spoke to each other, it was like literally, can you move out of my way? I'm trying to like go to the store or something.
Right. Right. What's unusual about this story is that Lawrence, I believe, too, is our voiceless. He was wrongly accused. He didn't have anything to do with this.
Absolutely not.
But it wasn't him. It's not him who's coming through to us.
I know.
It's Emily.
What do you think she wants?
I don't know. I mean, you're the one who was picking up on the woman. What do you think? Why do you think she's coming through about Lawrence?
Specifically in regards to Lawrence, I think she feels bad because Lawrence was convicted of her murder and he really had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think some of her own mysterious behavior created confusion about who killed her that also led the way to Lawrence's conviction. What do you think?
Well, I want to know from you, because I know you have strong feelings about this. I want to know from you, like, why did Emily have so many secrets? Why did she have a love interest that she wasn't upfront about to her friends? Like, where was she going? Why was she all dressed up? Like, why did she quit her job? What gives, Emily? Like, what do you think her secret was?
I know exactly what this is.
Oh my gosh, please explain.
Okay. So Emily was either going out with a younger guy that was like way younger that she was like cougar towning it. You know what I mean?
I do.
And so it was probably like a bad look. Like if she would tell like her friends and family like, oh, you're going out with like Oakley, like he's not taking you seriously. Like he's a young kid and like she's quote unquote nursing him back to health. So she's probably giving him attention, money, funding to support whatever ailment he's saying that he has. So that's what I think. Also, I feel like whoever this was, and I'm not saying it's Oakley, although Oakley,
suspect. Oat, like Quaker oat. Oatley.
Yeah. What am I saying?
Oakley, like the tree. Oak. It's oat. Oatley.
Oat. Oat. Oatley.
All right. Wonderful.
Anyway,
keep going.
Anyway, that kid, he is a suspect to me, even though I can't say his name. But I think that
the people of Scituate agree with you.
I think whoever it was really was planning. This was like a long scam. I feel like she was catfished. I feel like the person didn't need taken care of, wasn't had any kind of ailment. And I feel like once that was becoming clear and it was harder for him to keep producing reasons why he needed her attention and her money, he decided to like get one big haul by pretending to marry her. And that's why she was all dressed up. That's why she left her house. That's why she left her job. And they were going to move to somewhere, get married and start a new life together. That's what she was assuming. But instead, he gets her in the carriage that she rents, by the way, shoots her, tries to beat her to be unrecognizable, and then returns the carriage back. That's what I think happened.
Wow.
What do you think?
Wow. That to me makes more sense than Lawrence, than her having a relationship with Lawrence.
And I have just about the same amount of evidence as the prosecution had.
Exactly.
So very sad.
Very, very interesting. So let's review our hits for a second. The Pike, the fact that we were on Hartford Pike and we were on Danielson Pike, and the mm-hmm. Pike seems significant is because Emily's body was found just off Hartford Pike.
It's true.
And when we were in historic Hopkins Mills and I was taking pictures and Apple was labeling them North Scituate, that is so odd because that's where Emily was murdered.
I looked at my phone when you said that earlier and mine does say Hopkins.
It does. That is so odd.
Mm-hmm. Also, I want to say that the Hopkins Mills where we're at, it was the Hopkins farm that heard the noises of the carriage. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's the same name, Hopkins, mm-hmm. for sure. Also, when I was there and I said heavy-hearted shot in the chest, she died to a bullet in the chest just above her heart.
That makes me so sad.
I know. It makes me sad too. But like you said, she went fast and she didn't know it was coming because she was shot in the back.
I know. But the thing is that she got all dressed up thinking that she was going to her own wedding. And it turned out she was going to be at basically a funeral.
Maybe.
You see what I'm saying?
I don't know that she thought she was going to her wedding. I don't know that to be true.
I do. My psychic ability tells me.
All right.
My psychic ability tells me so.
Jill, why do you think there were two shots when there was only one bullet in her? Because the Hopkins family heard two shots. Do you think it was an echo, or do you think that the gun went off and then the second shot got her?
I do think it was an echo. I think it was just the one shot.
Okay. Just wondering.
What do you think?
I could see if the guy was holding the gun in his pocket angled up, how like that's really awkward.
Mm-hmm.
I could see how it could accidentally go off and then it could like turn it like a second later and get her in the back.
Yeah, but if it accidentally went off, she would have been turned.
It would have alerted her.
Yeah, that's my only thing. She would have been turned towards him.
Mm. More of the mystery. What do you think about the fact that you got the urge to text our friend Emily?
I mean,
at the same time that all of this other stuff was happening.
That is crazy, because when you put it like that in the context of our day, you would think that we would have texted Emily and Kirsten when we were in Kirsten's hometown.
Right. Not just randomly in this spot. It's almost like Spirit was like, Emily, like whispering the name to you. And you're like, oh, Emily, I guess I should text Emily.
Right. No, I agree with you 100%.
So weird.
And it just reminds me, like when we talk about what we do on our road trips and how when Nicole Bigley was with us and we're like, write it down. Everything you're thinking, everything you're saying.
Everything.
Everything. Everything could be relevant. Spirit just used our friend Emily to be like, Emily. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And then that female spirit energy excited to go home to Newport.
That could have been Emily.
Emily Chambers. She was from Newport and she had
lived
moved
there
to Providence.
20 years.
20 years.
It's a great location, Emily. I agree with you. It's lovely.
Wow. Okay, so what did you think of this story?
I was so impressed with the police work in the beginning, but the prosecution and the investigation just went south quickly. I was so excited to see like police, like old timey police doing old timey policey things and like, you know, getting the job done. But to bring in Larry, like, come on, bro. Like, this man did not do it.
Right. Well, there's the police investigation, and I think they did a lot of things right. But then when the attorneys and when the legal system got involved, that's when, like, really, you don't have a motive. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like how,
who greenlit this case?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But they were very convincing between Lawrence's buffoonery during the trial and the fact that people just didn't really like him. Do you know what I mean? And I think they wanted to stick it to him. You think you're going to be acquitted?
I think they wanted to keep him off the streets, too. Like, this is an opportunity to get him, like, out of, like, the vestibule of the hotels and wandering from pub to pub drunk AF.
True, because he would have been a menace doing that. And I also think that in a way, it kind of saved his life because, you know, he dried out in prison. Mm-hmm. And he was actually working as a bookbinder in the last years of his life. So he was actually being productive and he was getting fed and he was probably in the best shape he's been in for years, to be quite honest.
He did live surprisingly long for his earlier lifestyle.
So anyway, that is the story. And I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if at any point anyone else picks this up and studies this the way we have and decides that, you know, they have a take on it, because it's...
What do you think about my conclusions about her being catfished and tricked and led to her death?
I'm not sure what really happened. To me, there's still a mystery there. I respect your psychic impressions, but to me, it's still a mystery. I think what you said is just as is more plausible than what the lawyer said.
That's fair.
But let's talk about Patreon. You guys.
Oh my God. You guys.
You have to meet us on Patreon, because there's this whole side story about these showman psychics called the Baldwins, the mystical Baldwins, that are on this case. It's insane. The mystical Baldwins.
And Harry Houdini took an interest in the mystical Baldwins, and he had really strong opinions. And it turns out Houdini, not the nicest person.
So we are going to talk about the mystical Baldwins and their involvement in this whole sensation regarding the murder of Emily Chambers. There's a tie to Houdini. That is on tier two. If you want to support us on Patreon, go ahead at tier one. Just send us a couple bucks a month. Help us keep going. We really appreciate it. It is our patrons who keep this podcast alive. We love all our listeners. But our patrons, they keep us going.
For less than a cup of coffee once a month, you can support your favorite mystics. Just sign up now.
Wow. Right? Right. At tier three, you get extra content. And at tier four.
Let's do a telethon. Let's do a telethon. I would love it. We could do like ring, ring, telethon. Hi. Jill Stanley, how much can you donate?
Can we make a tote? Can we put together a tote?
Yes, coming soon, our new logo. That's going to be, you guys, I'm so excited about that. Yes, yes, and yes. Okay.
So much. We are all over the place. And tier four, we have our monthly Zooms. You can join us. And if you're shy, that's okay. You get the recorded Zooms to watch afterwards. We've got a great group of people. What a great community.
We do. We have the best. So, you guys, as if we didn't ask you to do enough, but please like, download, subscribe, and share with your friends the Common Mystics podcast wherever you're getting your favorite pods. Check us out on all our socials at Common Mystics Podcast. Please leave us a positive review, because we enjoy reading them and it brings us life.
Yay. Thank you so much. Love you.
Thank you guys. Bye.
Bye.
This has been a Common Mystics Media production. Editing done by Yokai Audio, Kalamazoo, Michigan.